Namaste, and welcome to the Om Sam Yoga and Ayurveda podcast.
A space to dive into how we as humans can live more intentional, ethical, and sustainable lives.
And how we can come into harmony with ourselves, others, and nature in the process.
We share tips to help you cultivate a healthy body, calm mind, and a strong purpose through traditional Vedic wisdom of yoga and Ayurveda.
My name is Aaron Petty. I'm a yoga teacher, a teacher trainer, and a yoga therapist, but above all, a student of this great tradition.
My name is Paige Taylor. I'm a yoga teacher, an Ayurvedic health consultant, an advocate for sustainable living, and a lover of all beings.
And on this week's episode, we're going to be diving into the question, is yoga a cult?
Such a heavy word and such a heavy topic, really. And this episode has been in our awareness for probably about 2 years now.
Yeah, it's been brewing.
It's been brewing, and we've been waiting for the right time to share our feelings and our thoughts. We've been waiting for the integration. We've been waiting for just, yeah, the right moment to arise. And last week, in real life time, I'm not sure when you're listening to this, it was Guru Purnima, which is a special occasion in the Vedic calendar that happens once a year. Purnima is the full moon, and the Guru is this specific full moon, which they say is the brightest full moon of the year.
Yeah, and I was looking at the news and it was like super moon, big bright moon. And it is. It's seen as the biggest, brightest moon of the year, which means that it's the moon that best illuminates the darkness. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the Guru is. Mm-hmm. So I want to start with a story, because you know how much I love stories.
Yeah, you do love a story.
So it's the story of the first yoga class that I ever went to. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what your experience of your first yoga class was. It was probably with your auntie, so it was a bit safer.
Yeah.
But for me, it was like going into this studio, and I had no idea what yoga was. Mm. I had no idea what a yoga studio was about. I didn't know anything about it. And I remember doing this class. There was, you know, 20, 25 people in this class. Everyone got all sweaty. And then at the end of the class,
they
chanted Om. And I remember the first time I had that experience, the words that came into my head were, is this a cult?
Yeah.
And I don't think it's an uncommon thing.
No, I definitely don't think so. I know as like business owners, we are so, so aware of, you know, making sure that new people that come in feel like heard and accepted and just like feel really welcome, because it kind of is a little scary if you have no idea what's going on, especially our studio. Like, we're not really like that of much of a modern approach. We're very traditional, and you know, there's the big deities on the altar, and there's no feet towards the altar, and there's all these kind of like things that arise in our studio, and there is a lot of chanting Om, depending on what class you go to. But yeah, there's a lot of things that we know that if we just get a completely new person to yoga, that it can be a little bit confronting.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the reason for that is that yoga is not a mainstream activity.
And well, it is, but it's classified as exercise.
Yeah, but even then, like, it's not mainstream exercise, even if you were taking that approach. There's all of these other elements of the practice that kind of make their way in. Mm-hmm. And at their very essence, they are kind of religious practices.
Yeah.
And I think that blending between what is a traditional religious practice and then a modern exercise practice is what kind of makes yoga a bit culty.
Mm.
So I think that as we dive into this episode, I want to do like a bit of a disclaimer.
Yeah, good idea.
Maybe that some of the topics that we'll discuss may be a little bit triggering for some people. Especially if you've had experiences in a high demand group, or you've been involved in a cult or something yourself.
Or if you're very invested in your identity as a yogi.
Yeah, or in a very specific lineage of yoga.
And that the information that we share is just our experience and our understanding and our perception of it. And that it doesn't mean that it has to be yours, and it doesn't mean that we're, you know, influencing your you know, ideas based on this as a cult leader would. But it's just been on our hearts. And I think that especially as business owners, especially as yoga teachers, there was a shift for us in the last two, three years that we haven't really voiced publicly. And yeah, I think that that needs to be addressed. And so, yeah, welcome to this episode.
Thank you for joining us.
And there's nothing too heavy in here. Like, don't worry, we're not the cult leaders. And, you know, it's all good.
That's something a cult leader would say. Only cult leaders feel the need to say that they're not cult leaders.
I don't know how to introduce this episode. Just no, bear with us.
I'm gonna start. So I think what we're trying to get at is that yoga is not all love and light. And as much as us yoga teachers try to portray that, there's actually a very dark side to yoga history that is not often talked about.
Mm.
And because it's not often talked about, it's something that a lot of people don't know about.
Mm.
That especially in the last 100 years or so, there have been some very dark and disturbing things that have happened in the name of yoga.
Mm.
And I think that shining a light on this can be helpful to us in shaping the way that we practice and shaping the way that we receive yoga. Because it's really about context and mm-hmm. allows us to become more selective around where we find our information and how we view the information that we're receiving and also how we choose to practice our yoga.
Yeah, and going back to this idea of guru, like shining the light on darkness, you know, we speak about it so much in our trainings and in our classes and in our podcasts that when prana shines light on things, it does not discriminate on what it shines light on. And so thus, these things can be uncomfortable to chat about and they can be, yeah, just uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the essence of yoga is that we are looking for the truth.
Yeah.
And sometimes in the pursuit of truth, we find things that are uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think for us, this was massive.
Yeah.
Like we
found
some
uncomfortable things.
Yeah, we were so and still are so invested in yoga as far as like our very identity. We both are yoga teachers. We are yoga business owners. We're yoga practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
Our whole life is built around yoga.
Mm.
And so when this specific topic came to the surface for us, it was very confronting. And I think for me personally, it had me questioning, well, is this the path that I want to be on? Do I want to continue practicing and teaching yoga? Do I want to continue sharing this with my community?
I remember going on a walk with you and you being like, I'm not going to teach yoga anymore.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, no. No, no, you can't do that.
Yeah. Okay. So first I want to dive into what is a cult, because I think that it's a term that gets thrown around a lot.
Too much almost.
And yeah, I mean, even in pop culture, you know, there's like celebrities have a cult following.
Yeah, like cult comes from the word culture.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So I ripped this off of Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And it's just the Wikipedia description as to what is the meaning of the word cult.
Okay.
Cult is a term in most context pejorative for a relatively small group, which is typically led by a charismatic and self-appointed leader who excessively controls its members, requiring unwavering devotion to a set of beliefs and practices which are considered deviant or outside the norms of society. This term is also used for a new religious movement or other social group which is defined by its unusual religious, spiritual, philosophical beliefs and rituals, or its common interest in a particular person, object, or goal. This sense of the term is weakly defined, having divergent definitions both in pop culture and academia. So, for the context of this episode, we are going to define a cult as a religious or spiritually oriented group surrounded by a charismatic leader. That group is usually a high demand group and expects its followers to adopt a certain set of beliefs, lifestyle, and practices. And it usually isolates the members and exploits them for the leader's financial gain.
Mm. And it's just so interesting to just like start with that, because especially in the modern movement that we're in right now, there's so many people pushing back against the social norms. There's so many people with new beliefs, new ideologies, new whatever, that are outside of the social norm and creating movement. You know, like we could even just look at the, you know, many modern breathwork businesses that have popped up in the recent years. And it's much of the same. Like, you know, within all of this stuff, there's so much, like especially yoga, there's so much pushing back against the social norms. Mm. And of course there's always going to be somebody in charge of that. But I think that what really kind of like speaks to me as like a point of difference is that this idea that there's like manipulation and there's exploitation and this idea of financial gain through that movement.
Yeah. And I think that it's inherent in yoga because yoga is such a powerful practice.
Ooh. Yeah, totally.
And it can really transform us in a way that is life-changing and life-shaping.
Mm.
And it will change the way that we view the world and see ourselves.
Mm.
And so therefore, there is opportunity in that for the right kind of charismatic leader to misuse that power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I think that before maybe we even get into it, there's back in the day, you know, when like as we're about to get into, there was this idea of guru culture, that there was always going to be somebody like through the traditions of yoga, like our practices and our techniques were passed down from guru to student.
Yeah, they call it Guru Parampara.
Yeah.
From the teacher to the student.
And I think that we have to reflect on those times that were a little bit different to our modern context in terms of like life and society and what was going on. And also that most commonly, really back in the day, these gurus were spiritually enlightened beings, like highly, highly enlightened beings. And now we're kind of in a society where anyone could say they're enlightened and not actually have that full absorption into samadhi or into that higher states of being, but are still living on this earthly plane with their earthly body, with their earthly karmas. And I think that's kind of what shone a light on it for me, was that, you know, these people, the people that leading these movements in the modern day still have their earthly karmas intact.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of it comes down to perceived authority more than anything, that it's like in the modern day, we can create a podcast. We can put out pictures or videos of us saying whatever we want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And with the rise of social media and, you know, even just in the modern social climate, there's almost like a yearning for religious leaders because we don't really have that in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know, I grew up in a school and the religious leaders, the religion teachers were kind of like the dorky ones.
Mm.
And they didn't really have any of the students' respect. And therefore, I think there's just like a societal yearning for someone to show us the way.
Totally.
On top of that, we don't really have like rites of passages, like rites of passage rituals. We don't have, you know, the parents in a lot of situations teaching the children, this is the right way of living. This is how we live in our society. Mm-hmm. We live in a very free society where you can do whatever you want and be whatever you want. And we're kind of taught that from a young age.
And that can be overwhelming.
Yeah. And so it kind of creates this landscape where it's very easy for us to fall under the influence of a teacher.
Yeah.
Especially someone that claims to know all the answers and live the right way and, you know, have access to God.
Mm.
So, I think back to where we started was that the yoga tradition was spawned within what we could call guru culture.
Mm-hmm.
That each kula, you call it each community. Had what they called a kula guru, which means that that was the spiritual teacher of that community.
Mm-hmm.
And you read any of the old stories like the Ramayana, Mahabharata. In the Ramayana, like, Ram comes from a kingdom called Ayodhya, and in that kingdom they have what's called a Kula Guru, and his name is Vashistha. And you might even know Vashistasana, which is the side plank. It's named after the sage Vashistha.
And if you're coming to India with us, you'll get to go and see that very cave where Vashistha cognized.
Yeah. And so that teacher was Ram's teacher, but he was also Lakshman's teacher, and he was also Bharat's teacher. He was the teacher of all of the young people in that kingdom. And they would leave their home at a young age, 10 or 12, and they would go to live in an ashram with their guru, and they would receive their education. So it's even a different education system to we have now. There would be one teacher that teaches all the students, and he would teach them in yoga and meditation and warfare and mathematics and astrology and everything that you could imagine. So in our modern context, we don't have that. We live outside of the guru culture.
Yeah.
And so we come into yoga and we then start to maybe travel into some more traditional teachings, some more traditional teachers and lineages. And we get exposed to that without the context for it. And you see people kind of bowing down, touching the feet of the guru. You know, the guru comes and touches them on the forehead and gives them their blessings, does the ceremony. And it's kind of all revolved around this central figure. And so we see that. And from our Western perspective, we think, okay, this person has the answers. This person is God. This person is whatever. And I think that's the biggest mistake, is this kind of like putting a teacher on a pedestal.
As the human.
Yeah. And even in these stories, like the Ramayana, Ram's guru, Vashistha, has a feud with Sita's guru, who's called Vishvamitra, and they hate each other. And they're trying to shape their students in order to fulfill their own karma.
Yeah.
And to wage their own battle between them.
And that's the human karma. Like, that's the human experience influencing the state of the guru. That the, like, that truly, if you're looking at the one of the guru, like the one that is, you know, beyond all of the gunas, the one that is like not affected by the pressures and the thoughts and the, you know, desires of the human experience. But that's just not the case.
It's a very, 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 very rare kind of person.
Yeah.
And there are many people who claim to be that thing. But as we'll get into, many of those people who claim to be that thing, their actions don't align with their words.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So that's the idea of guru culture. Now, the question is, how has this gone wrong as yoga has come to the West?
Yeah, that is the question.
And maybe you're aware of this, maybe you're slightly aware of it, maybe you're completely oblivious to it. But in the recent history of yoga, there have been many gurus who have abused their power in some incredibly horrible ways.
Yeah.
And we're not going to name any names because we're not in the game of naming names. But I think it probably moves us into a conversation around lineage. What is lineage? Lineage is guru parampara, from teacher to student. And from that student who becomes a teacher to the next student, to the next student, to the next student, to the next student. Lineage represents an unbroken line of teachers and students.
And why is that important?
Well, it's important because each of those lineages has their own set of beliefs.
And
practices. They have their own set of practices. They have their own way of understanding yoga and they have their own way of applying yoga, which means that every lineage you visit, the yoga will be completely different.
Or maybe similar.
Or maybe slightly similar, or maybe there'll be some things that are similar and some things that are different.
But I guess why it's, yeah, like perceived as so important, lineage-based practices in lineage-based yoga, is that it's a direct passing down of practices and techniques that teachers have embodied, that teachers have practiced, that teachers have seen the effects of, and they pass that down to their students. And then the students become the teachers and the teachers pass it down.
Yeah. And I think what's powerful about that, like there's a lot of power in those lineages, because we can know that someone has practiced these for an entire lifetime.
Yeah.
I think the difference between a lineage-based practice and a modern practice is that a lot of modern practices, someone's just made up and said, wow, this is really good for everyone, and started teaching it, but we really don't know what the effects are in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years' time. Whereas with the lineages, there's kind of this assumed trust that my teacher's done this practice for their whole life and their teacher did it for their whole life and their teacher did it for their whole life. And we're leaning into the knowledge and experiences of the ancestors down that line.
And even then, like just like as a little bit of a disclaimer, like even then the practices might not be good for you. And the practices might not suit your body type. It might not suit the current society that we're living in. And so it's a very interesting conversation, because these practices can be so potent and so important, but they can also be completely irrelevant.
Totally. So what Paige and I share from, and I think what makes us a little bit different to most modern yoga studios, is that most of what we share is lineage-based. But what makes us slightly different to a lot of the lineage-based schools is that we don't necessarily prescribe to one lineage. That actually we've studied under many different lineages. That my first teacher was a Tibetan monk, and he grew up in Tibet with the Dalai Lama in the Tibetan Buddhist school. Not only that, but he studied under all of the Tibetan Buddhist schools and became what's known as a Rime master, and he was a master of all of the lineages. He was my first teacher, taught me how to meditate when I was 16. Very grateful. Then I came into yoga and I found myself in a completely different lineage, which was kind of the modern Vinyasa lineage. And that had its own set of practices that were entirely different. It didn't really have a big focus on meditation or pranayama for that matter. It was mainly asana. I stepped outside of that and I found another teacher who was steeped in a completely different lineage. And there was many things that I was familiar with, meditation, asanas. And there was many things I wasn't familiar with, like mantras and yantras and mudras. And I came into that lineage and it was a whole different world, right? And from there, I've studied in multiple other lineages and I've taken something from all of those places and mainly the things that are applicable to me and the things that I feel are applicable to our community and will be beneficial for our community.
And I think that's so important. I think that when we look to the idea of guru culture or the idea of cults in general, you know, one of the discerning points is that there's an opposition to beliefs that are outside of the system that you're following. And I think that that exists within everything. But it's a very interesting position to be in, to be able to take a open mind without any tainted illusion, to be able to perceive things in different ways that are different to yours. I know that, you know, even for an example, like when I went fully vegan, that there was this, like opposition of my beliefs, like that I couldn't understand and I had no empathy for the people that chose to eat meat. And that was a limit of my experience and my beliefs and my values. Because, you know, if I cared so much about the empathy and the compassion for these animals, but then I had no empathy or compassion to people that didn't align with the same values as me, like there's a contradiction there.
Yeah, for sure. And so I think this is what's gone wrong in modern lineage-based yoga,
mm-hmm.
is that people fall into a specific lineage,
mm-hmm.
and that lineage is built around a central teacher,
mm-hmm.
and the teachings are the interpretation of how that teacher sees the world.
And I think there's no wrong in that. Like, I think that if you are in a single lineage with a single teacher and that you are practicing and that you are getting out of that lineage and those practices what you perceive to be, you know, an incredible experience, then that's great. I think the only advice that I'd give into that perspective is that you just keep an open mind constantly and always question things. And it doesn't have to be in a negative way, like, oh, you know, does this really work or who really are you or anything like that? But it's just constantly like questioning your own identity, questioning your own beliefs, questioning your practices and like why they've been given to you. Just like keep a mind that is curious.
Yeah, curiosity.
Yeah.
Cool. And so, yeah, I think going back to the where has this gone wrong, we see this rise in these yoga lineages, mm-hmm. or not even the lineages, but these yoga cults that are a teacher calling themselves a guru and then abusing power.
Mm-hmm. And what does that look like?
There are so many examples of this. And I don't want to name any names, but we see these kind of like teachers with huge followings,
mm-hmm.
that have hundreds and hundreds of, if not thousands of students going through these teacher training programs, bowing down to them, and the teachers telling them, this is what you have to believe, this is how you have to practice. It starts to isolate the students from their friends, from their families, to a point where that's teacher becomes all-powerful and starts to abuse their power, whether that's through sexual abuse, verbal abuse,
financial abuse.
You know, the teacher keeps asking for money, more money, more money. The students don't have any more money to give, and therefore they're kind of stuck in this situation where all of their money is going into this teacher or this foundation, whatever it's called. And they're finding it hard to make ends meet. They're not able to have any other social commitments or life outside of this organization. Mm. And then bad things start to happen.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, we've obviously said we're not naming names, and that's for, yeah, really important reasons to us, but you can do so much research into it, really.
You like, really could. If you go onto Google, interested,
yeah,
and you type in yoga cults, there's hundreds of examples of this.
Yeah, and I think that when we had our own experience that we'll go into in a moment, that really opened the can of worms to open the blind eyes that maybe a lot of our teachers had taken in the past, and us as well, and just really see and find the truth. Like Aaron said, that's what yoga's all about, is finding the truth. And we can't be afraid to find that truth, even if it's a little uncomfortable.
And I think like if your yoga practice and your yoga teacher are limiting your capacity to experience life,
mm-hmm.
and to experience yourself,
mm-hmm.
this may be time to start asking some questions.
Yeah, totally.
Now, in a lot of these situations, the group is built around an ashram setting where you may go to a specific place where this specific lineage is taught, and you would kind of be able to stay there for months, if not years on ends, to be learning yoga from this specific teacher.
And it's not always like that.
It's not always the case. Sometimes it happens online. Sometimes it happens where you go and then you go home.
And a lot of the great influences of this, I guess, back in the day was when the yoga started to transition away from India. And the teachers sent their students out to go teach in America mainly as the first option.
And then Australia.
And just the change of modern context and the change of modern society in these places have, yeah, greatly affected this whole issue.
Cool. So let's maybe talk to our personal experience a little bit. So we, at a certain point, started studying with certain teachers. And at that point, everything kind of started to change. Our style of teaching started to change. Our style of practice started to change. The way that we saw yoga started to change, and the way that we started to see the world was different. And I think for me, like, the red flags were, this is the only way.
Yeah, 100%.
That kind of language, like, this is the truth. This is the only way you should be practicing yoga.
This is the real yoga.
Yeah. Or even like language as to like everyone else is wrong. Like everyone else has it wrong and we have it right. And so if you stick with us, you will be carried towards greatness and everyone else will be left behind. This was the kind of language that we were receiving from our teachers.
And it's enticing.
Super enticing, because it's like, oh, okay, well, if everyone else is wrong and I'm right.
And it makes sense in my body, you know, like these practices work for me. These practices make sense for me. Like, oh, it makes sense that that's the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And every claim had a practice or something to back it up. So we kind of got really invested in this. And for me personally, I remember coming home back to Berwick and then not being able to relate to the people that I used to, not being able to have the same conversations with people, even like just my close friends and my family, just like, oh,
I feel like that was me when I went vegan.
Veganism is a cult.
Totally, yeah.
So there's kind of this like, oh, no one understands me. No one gets where I'm coming from. No one could possibly have the experiences that I've had, and they'll never understand. So I may as well discard them. They're not useful to me because I have this new family who do understand me and do get me.
I think you're like over-exaggerating it just maybe a touch.
Not at all. Okay. That was totally the experience that like, I didn't feel like I could relate to the people around me anymore. And therefore, I was even more invested in the relationships that I'd cultivated through this specific group and this specific teachings. And so I would kind of default to having conversations with people who did understand the knowledge and did understand the context and did understand where I was coming from and could speak the language that I was speaking now all of a sudden. Yeah, and I think it was like that. It was an uncomfortable experience in hindsight. But in the moment of it, I was like, well, I'm blessed. I'm blessed with this knowledge and I'm blessed with something new and I'm blessed with something that you'll never be able to understand. So for me, there was kind of like a relationship breakdown. And I think that happens coming into yoga in general, but this was like an accelerated relationship breakdown where I just felt like I didn't have any friends and I didn't have anyone who understood me except for these people that I was learning from and the people that I was learning with.
And what, this was like prior to me?
Yeah. And so, well, it's funny because when I met you, the reason that I was so attracted to you was because you were within the same lineage and you understood everything.
Bloody heck.
And I was like, wow, what are the chances that there's this one girl that's involved in this same lineage that I am that will understand me in a way that no one else could?
And I mean, I think my experience is quite different. Like, just like, I don't know how to put it, but like, I just like didn't really think anything of it. And like, you know, and like for me, like the teachings that I got were like the only teachings that I'd had. And that I didn't think that it was like this is my life now and I have to cast this past version of me off. It was nothing like that. It was just that I'd learned this incredible practice of yoga and that it was wonderful and beautiful and that I just wanted to share it. And I mean, of course, just like as you mentioned, like when you come into that yoga world as it is, that kind of stuff starts to happen where you question, you know, your beliefs and you question your values and you question the people that you hang out with and stuff like that. And it wasn't for me from a place of, I don't know, I'm better than you or...
Yeah. I had studied already outside.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'd come to something new and I'd fully invested myself in it. And I was like, this is the way. I'm going this way now and nothing else matters.
Yeah.
So I think from that, as a teacher, what shifted in me...
Mm-hmm.
was that I started to push my ideas onto other people.
100%.
And I started to tell people how they should be practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of really from a very stern and strict perspective that it's
as
like, this is how you do it and this is the only way. And if you don't do it this way, you're out.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of mentality.
Yeah.
And it came down to like sadhanas, like you had to practice for 90 minutes a day and you had to do it every single day. And if you didn't, you have to start again.
Yeah. Yeah. Very strict.
Very strict and stern. On top of that, I found myself as a teacher trying to climb this ladder to like almost appoint myself as a leader to like what we spoke about before, like to create a perceived authority in what I was saying. And I was doing that just by regurgitating everything that my teachers had told me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just like, what who happens? Was I to know that?
Yeah.
That was the example that was given to me.
Exactly.
And so therefore that was the example that I followed.
Mm.
On top of that, I started to really view the individual complexity through like a standardized lens, that I could see this person, I could only see them really through the lens that I was viewing them.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't see outside of that. I couldn't see that they had this whole life with all these relationships and their job and their partner and their own set of beliefs and their own religious background. Mm. And I would just try and fit them into the mold of the framework that I had and then make them practice through that lens.
Mm.
And so I think that like for me personally, it was very like, it was a very rigid structure that I wasn't able to see outside of because I was so deeply invested in it.
Yeah.
And then it all fell apart.
Crumbled.
It did. It crumbled.
And I remember getting, like contacted from one of our really close friends and teachers that this teacher that was higher than her and higher than us and somebody that we had both studied with, like had misconduct.
That's one way to put it. Stop playing with those because they'll make noises.
And that had, done some things that were not so great.
We would call him a naughty swami.
Harry.
No. So, yeah, and I think that was a really important pivotal point for us because we were both so invested in this way of teaching. We were both so invested in this specific lineage. And to us, this person was the guru.
Yeah.
And that was our mistake. It was our mistake because, and this is just in hindsight, because we had put this person on a pedestal. We had in our own minds and in our own hearts said this person is the example of a perfect human being. And the reason that we were seeing the world in that way was because that was what our teachers were telling us.
Exactly.
That's what our friends were telling us. They were saying this person is the person.
Yeah.
If you were to go to a teacher of yoga, this is the teacher that you should go to because this person is perfect. And we should all fall at their feet and touch their feet. And I remember those words coming out of my mouth. We were going to meet this teacher and I said, I'm going to touch his feet.
Oh, God.
Cringe. I didn't touch his feet. Regardless, there was a real like idolization of this person.
Yeah, right. And then there was misconduct. That actions didn't line up to the words coming out of their mouth. And I think that that's when the human experience comes in. That's when the human karmas come in. And I remember that, like, I wasn't, like, I was affected by it as it fell apart, but definitely not as much as Aaron, because he was like 100% invested in it. And he's a kapha type, so he's very attached, whereas I'm like very detached in general.
Yeah.
And I remember as it was falling apart that one of the people in the same community as us that we love dearly, like, shared this thing of like, I don't remember the context, but it was like the guru is a cooked goose, or like, I don't remember, but that's what came up. But what I took from it in the entire post, not just that one sentence, was that these people are still human. And if they haven't transcended the complete human experience, then they're still affected by the gunas, by the karmas of the human experience. And that we all have these karmas that always are at play with silly things that happen to us. And that was just something that played out in their life.
Yeah.
And it was confronting for us because it was like, oh my gosh, like, I've just invested my whole, you know, beliefs and my money, and not all of our money, of course, but just little bits of money.
A lot of our money.
into this teacher, and that they were not who we thought they were.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was uncomfortable.
It was uncomfortable.
Because we really, in our idealistic minds, wanted there to be an example.
Yeah. And we wanted to be a teacher. Like, we wanted there to be a teacher. We wanted to be somebody that we could always go to that would have the same context as us and that could answer the questions as us. And that wasn't the case. That fell apart. And it was the most liberating moment maybe of our lives, because we had to look outside of the box. We had to look outside of our experience and outside of our circle to grasp understanding of it.
Mm.
And that's what changed, I guess, our yoga teaching forever.
Yeah. And not only that, but we had to look inside.
Yeah.
We had to look inside.
Yeah, yeah.
To really start to discern, well, as I break away from this belief structure, which part of it is relevant to me?
And what do I trust?
Yeah.
Who do I trust? And I think that this is my favorite teaching out of this whole situation, and that it was recently shared on a podcast that I listened to with two people that I admire greatly, about Guru Purnima, the same kind of thing. And that the idea is that if, you know, you study under a teacher and then you no longer study under a teacher for whatever reason, like, the teachings are still relevant.
Yeah.
Like, that you still can take whatever you learned, whatever you embodied from that teacher with no taint. I mean, like, you can taint it if you want. Like, these teachings are tainted by that person. But it's just that person having a human experience. But the teachings and the practices, you know, if you felt the power of them, if you felt an embodied understanding of them, and if they feel relevant for you, then take them. You know, like, they are yours, and that you can practice and make them your own and change them however you want, and then you can share them in a way that feels relevant.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Mm. Love that.
Yeah. And that's just, like, really what I took from it, was that, you know, Aaron was ready to throw it all away, and I guess, you know, fair enough.
Yeah, I think for me it was like, if I'm following these teachings and this is where they end up,
no, thanks.
I don't want to follow them at all.
Yeah. And, you know, Aaron really went through this whole crisis about how to not become a cult leader, because yeah. He was worried that, you know, like, what if that ever happened to him? And, you know, I think there's just such different circumstances involved. And that's why we're a 50-50, you know, ownership of business, that there's never going to be space for that to happen. And Aaron is just not that kind of person anyway. But it was this real crisis for him, like, you know, I don't want people to look at me like that.
Yeah.
I don't want people to put me on a pedestal like
that.
And I
think it really did change my teaching forever, because it shifted in me the desire to have all the answers.
Yes, totally.
It shifted in me the desire to be the person
yeah.
that people come to with their problems.
Yeah.
And actually, it changed my teaching to
what
just
do you
reflect
think?
Things back. And it's a lot of the time people will come to me a question, and it'll be like, blah, 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 blah. I've got this thing, and this is this, and this is that. And my answer is, well, what do you think?
Yeah. And
what
that's
do you
powerful.
Think the best path is going to be?
Because they know. Most of the time, they already know. They just want the validity of the teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it was a massive, massive shift, a massive transformation for us to step away from that. And I think the other thing, the final thing that I might add to that is that sometimes that misconduct is a teaching of its own.
Oh, 100%.
Right? Even if it's not a conscious teaching from that teacher, they are still teaching you something. There is still a learning to be taken from that misconduct.
100%, 100%. And that's the thing is like that it's just about finding these silver linings. And like it's, you know, a bit of woo-woo spiritual bypassing, but like at the truth of it, that's it. Like, you know, if you have an experience that's uncomfortable, you know, feel the feelings, feel the discomfort, feel what arises. But like at the end of the day, what is it teaching me?
Yeah.
And for us, it was like teaching us to look inside.
Yeah.
And to stop outsourcing our power, outsourcing our intelligence, outsourcing our experience to somebody else, and to turn that inside so that, you know, we allow our true self, our hearts to be the teacher. We allow prana to be the teacher. That's something that Aaron is often speaking about, that we if we outsource, we're looking at nature. We're looking at prana, that intelligence of life force that enters and exits through our body, and that can be our teacher.
Yeah. And I think we've done an episode on this before, like the five expressions of the teacher or something like that.
Oh, yeah, something like that.
Your parents, nature, your life. Anyway, yeah, I think for me, like, sometimes the worst teachers are the best teachers.
Yeah.
And I've really realized that throughout my journey. I've had a lot of teachers over the years. And it's the ones that have treated me poorly or said something that I don't agree with or done something that's horrible that helped me to realize in myself what I don't want.
Yeah.
What I don't want to become, or what I don't want to perpetuate, or what I don't want to share or teach.
And I think we speak about this a fair bit in Ayurveda, is that like it's the kind of the same concept that, you know, in order to, we never know our truest state of balance. Like, I mean, we know it, but we don't know it in our minds, in our logical brains, that we don't know exactly what that true state of balance looks like, but we do know what the imbalance is. We do know what feels uncomfortable. We do know the symptoms. And that the more you become aware of those things that aren't that state of balance, and the more you remove them, the closer you get to knowing your true self.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've maybe just as a closing wanted to share, like, how do we come out of this? What's the solution? How do we move forward in this climate knowing that this exists in yoga? I'm a bit of a skeptic now. If anyone claims that they know the truth, or if anyone claims that this is the only way, immediately I'm skeptical. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to take this with a grain of salt. Because every religion ever has claimed soul access to the truth. And the truth is that there is no one truth.
No, exactly.
That the only truth is the truth
that's relevant to you.
Well, yeah, that's relevant to you, and the truth that transcends all truth.
Yes, that's true.
And that transcends all words, and that transcends all concepts.
Yeah, totally.
Right? And so any person who claims to see the truth has seen from their own limited perspective that truth, and are articulating it through the lens of their life and their learnings and their teachings.
And it may be 100% the truth for them. It may be 100% relevant for them, but it doesn't mean that it's applicable to everyone. It's not a one size fits all with this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's where it gets complicated.
So what's the solution? The solution is understanding the context through which information is shared with you. Context for me is everything, and the word context has really just come into my vocabulary over the last 2 years. And context means that it's the lens through which you look, right? If someone is sharing something with you, it is very important to understand where did they get the information? What is their life situation? How did they grow up? What lineage are they speaking from? What is their current stage of life? You know, there's so many different parameters through which we can share these different teachings. And so it's important to understand what is the context of the information that is being shared with you. And for me as a teacher, especially on our trainings, whenever I say something, I'll give the context first. I'll say, this is this and this and this, and I'm sharing this with you through this lens.
Mm. And you don't, like, every time we run a training, we always say, like, everything that we offer you in this experience is just like a jacket. You can try it on and you can see if it fits nice, or if you like the style, or if you like the color, if it looks good on you. And if you don't, you can just take it off.
Yeah, exactly.
That it's just like context and information and practices that, you know, we have learned and we have experienced, because that's all that teacher training ever is the experience and the culmination of practice of whoever you're studying under. Of course, there's going to be perspective bias, but the best that we can do as yoga teachers and yoga teacher trainers is to offer the perspective and then offer multiple different perspectives. Yeah. And start conversation. Well, what do you think? How does that sit for you? What are your beliefs? What are your opposing thoughts on this? And allow that starting of questioning to happen, that critical thinking that's so important
and so needed.
Yeah,
and I think that is something that we really take pride in with our trainings, is like there's never a one size fits all, and there's never a right or a wrong.
And even just in our yoga studio in general, like if somebody comes in and is like, this is not for me, cool.
Yeah.
You know, like we fully understand and appreciate that our style of yoga and what we have to offer is not for everyone. And we don't want it to be, you know, like we're happy to have the people that are interested and invested, and the people that aren't, we don't take it personally. We don't take offense. Like, that's cool.
And we don't try to convert them.
No, we just say like, oh, how about this studio? Have you checked them out? They might be a good fit for you. And we pass it off because, you know, there's nothing worse than somebody trying to hold on to something that isn't right for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, we're just sharing the yoga that works for us, and we're sharing the yoga that we think will be a good fit for the community that we have.
Yeah.
And that community is the Barrett community.
And on top of that, it's ever growing and ever evolving, especially as us as teachers. Like, we are studying so many different things at so many different times, and we're constantly seeking out different perspectives and different teachings on certain things that we, you know, teach so differently to the way we taught 3 years ago. I mean, not so differently, quite differently. It's just a different perspective, and it's a different lens that we share the teachings through.
Yeah. And I think that's also part of the solution, is finding more context for yourself. Like, study under different lineages, study under different teachers, learn from different people, and find the correlations and find where that balance of truth sits for you.
And that's the thing, is that like it's so important. Context is so important for everything in life, but specifically when we're talking about yoga and Ayurveda. Like, even when I'm speaking in Ayurveda with people, you know, it's like, oh, I'm experiencing this symptom, and it's like, cool. You know, people say that to me all the time. What's an Ayurvedic remedy for this? And it's like, come on, that's not how it works. Yeah. First of all, give me the whole bloody context. You have to fill out a 60-minute form so I can know everything that's going on, and then I can tell you this thing. And it's funny because, you know, this happened to me recently with someone I love very dearly, and it was like, I want an Ayurvedic remedy for this. And I was like, cool, well, it's probably to do with this, like your complete diet. Like, these are the things that I know they eat all the time that are triggering it. And then it was like, okay, well, I'm not really willing to change that. And it's like, cool, but like, then I can't help you. Then Ayurveda can't help you. You know what I mean? Anyway, that was a bit of a side note, but context is so important.
Yeah. And it's the same with yoga therapy. Like, people will come to me with a diagnosis.
Yeah. Yes.
I've got this disease. Yes. I've got that disease. I'm having this problem. The doctor told me this.
But how do you experience it?
How do you experience it?
Yeah.
Because without your context, the disease is irrelevant. Nothing, right? I have multiple clients with the same disease but completely different symptoms.
Exactly.
They have completely different experiences. Maybe one person, their disease gets triggered by the heat, and the other gets triggered by the cold.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if I just took everyone with that disease, lumped them into a category and said they're all sensitive to heat, the one that's sensitive to cold is going to have absolutely horrible time.
And that's the problem with modern medicine, but that's a whole different story.
It's a different story. It's a cult of its own. So that's another. And I think the main thing is just like, the more context you can have in relation to your yoga practice, the more equipped you will be to combat this issue.
Mm-hmm. And self-reflection, self-study, study, like, was the next it's one. Just so important to be constantly reflecting about how you feel about certain things, about how it feels in your body, how it feels in your practice, how it feels for you, you know? Like, you don't have to take everyone's perspective on as your own. Just, you know, the more that we become in tune, and that's what yoga really teaches us, is like how to become in tune with you and your experience and your highest self. And then from that place, you make educated, empowered decisions and actions.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's really important that, like, at the end of the day, yoga practice is not designed to connect you to someone else. It's to connect you to yourself. And the more deeply you can connect to yourself, the more agency you have to make the decisions and take the actions that will move you towards a state of health, a state of yoga, a state of enlightenment, whatever that is that you're chasing through your practice.
Yeah, and that's okay if you are studying under a teacher.
Yeah.
Like, that it's okay if you're studying under a teacher. This podcast is not that you shouldn't study under teachers, because we still study under teachers.
Yeah.
But it's about having the critical mind and the curious mind to think outside of the square and to take everything that gets taught to you and apply it to you and your experience and your context, and then share from that place.
Yeah. And if something doesn't fit well with you, then you don't have to take it on.
And it doesn't mean you have to let go of the teacher.
Yeah, for sure. I often have debates with my teachers about trivial things and about very serious things.
Yeah.
And sometimes we come to a conclusion and sometimes we just don't.
And that's okay.
And that's okay. Cool. The final thing is just taking accountability. Taking accountability for yourself, being honest with yourself, being honest with others, especially as teachers. Like, if you make a mistake or if you don't know the answer, take own accountability.
Yeah.
Just own it.
Exactly.
I don't know.
Let me check with my teacher. I don't know. Let me do some research. Like, there's literally no harm in saying that. And I don't know what part of us, especially in this community, thinks that we have to be the ones that know it all, because, oh my goodness, it's vast. It's so vast. You could never know it all, ever.
Yeah.
That, like, there's power in being like, oh, I actually don't know the answer to that. Let me do some research.
Yeah. Yeah, and doing the research and then coming to a conclusion and then testing it, and maybe it works and
maybe it
doesn't work.
Exactly.
Cool. And I think the final thing I'll share is a phrase that I really love, that a yoga teacher is no more and no less than a friend. That you should see your yoga teachers, yes, they're your teacher, and yes, there should be a mutual respect, and yes, there should be the context for that relationship, that in the context of this relationship, I'm the teacher, you're the student. But you should only ever see that person as your friend. You should not see them as someone that's higher than you. You should not see them as someone that you want to aspire to be. You should not see them as someone that you want to elevate yourself to, you know, be in line with. But they're a friend. And to realize that the best friends, they challenge you in a supportive way. And that they don't impose their beliefs on you, but they do push you toward growth and shine lights on things that are maybe uncomfortable or maybe that you can't see for yourself. I think that if you can find a teacher that supports you in that way, that challenges you but levels with you and treats you as their equal, then you've found a good teacher.
Totally.
And it's also really helpful if your teacher has a teacher. That if your teacher is still learning and still studying and still questioning their own beliefs and their own way of viewing things. Because that kind of teacher will not be rigid and stuck in their ways, and they will be open to adapting and shifting things to fit you as the student.
Totally.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So, a warning from us. Stay away from yoga cults.
I hope it wasn't as heavy as I don't know. It's just a heavy topic. And I think it's something I've definitely avoided for a long time. But I know it's so important to speak about because, yeah, it's not spoken about enough, and that we need people to speak about it so that you can have that curious mind, so that you can have that reflective mind and always question things that happen in your life and work out for you what's right and what's not right.
Yeah, and in a lot of these situations, like, this stuff just gets shoved under the rug and people just don't talk about it within that community as well as outside the community. Everyone wants to be for yoga, pro yoga. Everyone wants yoga to be the savior of the world. It is healing. It's good for you. It's the best thing in the world. We love yoga. But we just need to have these difficult conversations and know that it's not always the case.
Totally.
Yeah.
And that it's not for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not for everyone. Definitely not. There are many other practices out there would be equally as healing.
Exactly.
So if yoga is a good fit, then practice yoga. But if you do come into this experience like I did, let it be a teacher and don't lose your faith in yoga. That was for me the one of the biggest things was just like that I lost my faith in the practice because of a person.
Yes.
And like, it wasn't the practice. There was nothing wrong with the practice. There was something wrong with the person. And so for me, it really, after I went through that transition and I kind of lost my enchantment with yoga and this teacher, it like re-inspired me beyond anything I could ever imagine that like I have so much faith in yoga. I have so much faith in the practice and my practice is stronger than it has ever been before in my life. I love practicing and I love practicing in the context that I have and I love exploring new practices. I love exploring new teachers and new ways of looking at things and understanding things. I love to question my own beliefs.
Is that still going?
Yeah, it's still recording.
Cool.
Yeah, and I think that is something that I've integrated into myself is that I am just now more curious.
Yeah.
More curious to let my practice be the teacher and most of all, let myself be the teacher.
Yeah, that's it. And
we can always look to that inner guru that lives inside, that is our soul, our consciousness, our awareness, whatever you want to call that.
Yeah, and that there's nothing but gratitude for those who have led the way before us and before you, and that experience of, gratitude for the people that have passed down what they know and what they have experienced to us, whether we choose to continue to learn from them or we choose not to, but that essence of gratitude for this great tradition as it stands, as with all the impurities and imperfects of this human experience, gratitude for that.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, final thing we want to share is this. It's called the formula for embodiment. And it's something that was shared with me only a little while ago, maybe last year. And it really helped me to understand this process of taking teachings from a teacher and then applying them to our own life and ultimately sharing them. So stage one is that we learn, that we're diligent in our study. We go above and beyond to understand from the place of the mind what we're going to practice. Knowing that eventually, if we become too confident in what we know, it will be a stumbling block.
Yeah.
And so always we're learning. Stage number two is that we practice. We practice what we learned. We practice what's applicable to us and we practice what's appropriate to us. That there's a plan in your practice, that you're actually putting things into place in a sequential manner. We call it vinyasa krama. I'll be teaching a training on it next month. But we practice. The next is that we apply what we practice in the real world. That it is in some way relatable to our lives, that practice is consistent. And over time, as we apply the practice over and over and over and over, it becomes more and more and more refined. Stage number four is after the application of practice, we come to a realization. Yeah, we come to our own understanding. Usually after I've done a practice for 4 days, 108 days, I've spent some real time experiencing, exploring a practice. There'll be a moment of epiphany where, I get it. I understand the purpose of this practice. And then then you can share. And you can share in a way that's appropriate to the people that are standing in front of you. That you should always meet the people in front of you where you're at, not through the lens of your own experience, but through their understanding and their context.
Yeah, and your embodied experience.
Yeah. So we learn, practice, apply, realize, and then share.
Mm-hmm.
And I think moving forwards as yoga teachers, the more we can align ourselves with that process, the more we can understand the context of what we're learning and what we're teaching, the better off the modern yoga world will be.
Totally.
So yeah, that's it from us today.
Thanks for listening to
Hari
us.
Om.
Hope it was thought-provoking and some good juicy context for you.
We love context. Anyway, if you want to catch up with us online, you can find us on all social media platforms, omsom.yoga. Our website is exactly the same, omsom.yoga.
We've got some upcoming trainings. Like Aaron said, he'll be running a sequencing and energetics training at the end of August 2023. We also are running our 200-hour in India. There's literally only a couple of days left to sign up. That's September, 3 weeks immersive. We're also going to be running our yin training this November and then our 300-hour next year.
Yeah.
All the details are on our website. So if you feel the call to continue your study with us and to deepen your experience with us in some kind of way, then just contact us, get in touch, and we can have a chat about it or just have a browse through the website.
Yeah. And the final thing is that we don't take any money for this podcast. So if you found this conversation valuable, just share it with someone.
Yeah.
Send it to someone that you think could be interested in it, someone who's a yoga teacher or a yoga student. Just send it to them. Put the word out. The more people that can get into the podcast, the better, because we just love to share and we love to have conversations. And there's been so many people that have come into the studio and taken a big great voyage across Victoria to come with us and practice, and it's so nice. So
yeah,
we love to hear from you guys. If you have any questions about this episode, please just send us a message. We'll send you a reply. We can have a conversation.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah,
that's it.
How many times did you say
yeah? I love that. Cool. Well, thanks for listening.
Hari Om.
Hari Om.